Eric.
Hi, Charles.
Hi. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great.
So we're in Building 99 again.
Yes, we're in Building 99. We're here with, you know, John Paul and Ringo. Peter, Wolfram, and Rustan of the SpecSharp team.
Excellent.
And, you know, they have been doing extremely interesting work on bringing contracts to the masses.
Okay. So let's... What exactly is a contract from a programmer's perspective?
Well, let's ask the experts.
Cool.
So a contract is a way of expressing what the procedure is supposed to do. Right? In general, when you write code, you describe how to solve a problem. By specifying a contract, you also say what the problem is that you're going to solve and what the requirements are that you have. Like, what can you rely on when you start your procedure? And by putting this redundancy into the code, we can just do all forms of checking, like runtime checking, static checking, stuff like that.
So can you be a little bit more concrete? So kind of what kind of, you know, things would you like to express? Because, you know, if I write like a C# program, you know, don't I specify a contract already? You know, saying this takes an integer and returns a boolean.
So our contracts are much more elaborate than that because we specify semantic properties, not just syntactic or type properties. So, for instance, you can write preconditions that constrain the parameter values. You can write postconditions, making promises about the state in which you leave the method. You can write invariants saying what are the conditions under which an object is well-formed. And these things are very important to make explicit in the code, and many programmers do that anyway in the documentation. But now you can do it in a more formal way in the code, and then we have tool support that picks that up and does something with it.
Interesting.
Yeah, so in some sense what you are trying to do is actually making the design explicit by providing the contracts. And the best way might be actually to look into some code and see how we could specify a class with contracts.
Excellent. Let's do that.
Code is always good.
Code is great.
Okay, so if you can see some of what I have on the screen here, we're sitting in Microsoft Visual Studio, and where we have a plugin for the SpecSharp mode. And so I'm going to write a little class that is called Chunker. Chunker will have a string, a source string, that is going to divide up into little chunks. Each chunk is going to have some size, and we're going to remember how much of the string that we have returned already. And so far it looks very much like C#. I'm going to write a constructor that takes a source string and some given chunk size, and it will assign those to the fields. And of course, So far, it looks very much like a C# program that one would write. And now let me write the more interesting method, which is going to be the next chunk method, the method that is going to return the next chunk from our source string. More or less, what it's going to do is it's going to dig out a portion of the source string. It will take a substring of that. We'll skip the first n characters because we've returned those so far. And I will take the next chunk size characters. We'll return that string, but before we return the string, I will increment n by chunk size, which is the number of characters that we have. And now we finally see something interesting that our SpecSharp mode gives you in Visual Studio. Mm. So we see the squigglies. We have these turned on here at design time, so you don't have to hit the compile button in between, mm-hmm. and we get the number of error messages. The first one that we get is warning us about a possible null dereference, which is actually our type checker in SpecSharp, warning us about that we're dereferencing the SRC field whose type is string, which then allows it to have the value null. And this is one of the things that we find is a great benefit of using SpecSharp, that you get the non-null warnings about possibly null things at compile time. So, should I go on and show? What we would like to do is change the type of SRC. The type of it here is just string, which then allows it to be null. and we can change it to be a non-null string, which in SpecSharp you do by adding an exclamation point afterwards. So SRC is now declared to be a non-null string. We also have have another mode where you just type string, and that by default means that it's a non-null string, and then you have to write string question mark if you want it to be the nullable version of string. But in this demo, we're using the mode where we have to represent the bangs explicitly. So string bang says that it's a non-null string. Now we get a complaint in the by the type checker inside the constructor, which tells us that that the conversion from the source string that we got as a parameter into SRC might fail, because it might be null. And this is something that programmers face all the time with parameters that may or may not be allowed to be null and may or may not be passed in as null. And in this case, the compiler, the type checker, tells us that there's a problem if it's passed in as null. We could write some defensive code inside the constructor, but in this case, a better way to handle it is simply to change the type in the constructor to say that we're accepting only a non-null type string.
So this is kind of interesting because, that kind of defensive code really kind of spoils the kind of flow of your code, right? It's like, all the interesting bits get hidden because of all the kind of null checks and so on. But one question I have here is like, how, if I want to call this chunker from, say, Visual Basic that doesn't have these non-null types, how would that work? And where is the non-null check done? Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting question, Eric. The best way where it should be done is actually in the jitter, because the jitter knows from which context things are called, and it could actually exploit the fact that something is non-null by optimizing certain cases. In reality, what we currently do is that if you stay in the SpecSharp world, then we guarantee that on every path through your program where you specify that something is not null, that it is not null. But if you call it from VB, we don't give you any guarantee, and we fall back to what the jitter normally does. It throws an exception in case you dereference it. So in some sense, this is not safe for all of the languages on the platform, but it is actually a design that only works for SpecSharp.
Okay.
But there is a proposal on the table to, in some sense, bake it into the CLR. Whether they adopt it, that's a different story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a very interesting thing, because if you look at the JIT, actually, they do a lot of null checks, right? But every time you do a virtual call,
Yes. It
checks whether the receiver is not null. So all these checks could be just kind of eliminated if the type system was a little bit smarter.
Yeah. And you can do it in the bytecode verifier, for example, as well. So there's no reason that it has to be only SpecSharp specific. We can bake it into the runtime system if we wanted to.
Yep. So not only does our code get more kind of correct, but it can also get much more fast because we don't have to do all these null checks.
And the largest optimizations that one can do there are one could do it at every null dereference, which is done in some places, but often the hardware can just pick up those checks. But the compiler can optimize loops in a better way if it knows that certain things are not null, because then it knows that it doesn't have to check for things beforehand. The language specifies in which order you're supposed to receive these checks. So that's a place where research has shown that one can get good performance benefits also by having non-null information.
Interesting. So, that's a good segue into the next question is, what's happening here is you're making it easier for the compiler to do smarter things. I mean, let's talk a little bit about what this means after the code has been compiled, during compilation.
There are opportunities for the compiler to do smarter things, like we were just discussing with the performance.
Mm-hmm.
I think those things would be great to do. We don't have a path right now in our compiler that's going to change the code that's being generated, because it's in the jitter that where you're actually going to get this code. However, I see it more as it's a comfort to the program.
So can I ask one question there? Because if you look at the C# compiler, it will compile non-virtual calls into call verts to make this null check. But in your case, you could just use a normal call instead of a virtual call. Yeah. So you might be able to do some optimizations also without JIT support. Yeah.
That could be. Right. Yeah. And it might be interesting to know that in some sense we have extended the language once with additional type information. Namely, we introduced generics in order to make the program more reliable and more performant. Yep. We could do the same thing here. And we can also compare, in some sense, the strengthening of the contract with the additional bang, with the additional information that we put into the CLR when we introduced nullable, where we then suddenly said, okay, every value can now also be a null, so we enriched, actually, the domain. And here what we're saying is, for reference types, you want to do exactly the opposite. You want to take the null out of the possible values of that data type. So in some sense, it would be a much more orthogonal design if we would add the bang to the question mark that we have already.
So and where would that leave the kind of normal type? So then we have like, you know, non-null types, you know, nullable types. What happens with kind of normal types?
What are normal types?
Well, you know, you get, so if you say nullable, you know, you say this, you know, it might be null. And you say, you know, with a bang, it cannot be null. But what happens if I don't put, you know, no question mark and no bang? So now we have like three states of our types.
In our compiler, you choose which of those two modes you would use. And it would probably be terribly confusing if you choose different modes in different parts of your code. But in generics, there is the third option there, as you mentioned, actually does play a role. Because when you take a generic parameter of a generic type, then it could have been instantiated with a non-null type or with a maybe null type. And so there we support, you can either write just the name of that type, or you can write an exclamation point after which we says this is definitely the non-null version, or you can put a question mark afterwards, which has the effect of sort of shaving off the non-null portion of it, if you will, if it okay. has such a thing.
And so another interesting thing, so you said, like, you know, there was a mode in your compiler where you could kind of, you know, have the non-nullness as the default. And do you guys have any kind of, you know, numbers or something, kind of how much, you know, that would save you, or, you know, what are the benefits or the advantages of that?
Yeah, in some sense, when you look at existing programs, you see lots of non-null checks, and the most often occurring error that people are making is that something can be null. So in some sense, I think we made the wrong decision with our defaults when we started the language design. The default would have been that it's actually a non-null references, because that's the common usage of references. But since we didn't make that decision, exactly like Java didn't make that decision, now we have to live with the fact that we don't want to change the behavior of existing code, and so now we can only add additional annotations to make those distinctions, which becomes clumsier. Maybe in 10 years from now we have a new chance to design a new language and we get it right.
And this kind of comes back to the notion of baking types into the runtime, Eric? And we've had that discussion before.
Yes.
Just, yeah. I mean.
That's anyway. Kind of actually an interesting dilemma, right? Because the thing is, like, you know, what we said here is that it would be nice if the JIT would know about non-null types. But on the other hand, if you put too much kind of, you know, type information in the runtime, now you force all languages that compile into the runtime to know about this. And this kind of ties back to the other question that I had, you know, how does this interoperate, but maybe we can take that a little bit further. Suppose that, you know, the JIT would know about non-null types. Would that force all languages to kind of obey by the laws of non-nullness?
It would affect the library designs. The APIs would then have to say whether or not they expect and return non-null parameters. And the libraries affect all languages. One probably would not want to have two different versions of the libraries, but so in that case, one makes some choice for the libraries, and then the languages need to live up to that. Something that we do support in SpecSharp is for parameters. If you declare a parameter to be non-null, as I've just done in the constructor here, we actually do provide a runtime check there. So there, if you call it from VB, you would actually get a runtime check.
Okay, but so within SpecSharp, you're guaranteed that it's null null.
Yep.
And it might throw an exception when it crosses the boundary
Yes. And in some other places, we don't actually have such a runtime check. As Wolfram mentioned, that for example, if you declare a field to be null null, then there's no runtime check because we don't have a way to get to the field update statements in the other languages. They appear in some other code. Yeah. Whereas for checking parameters on entry, it's easy because at least we can check it after the call has been made, just on entry.
Okay, so then to go back to the code, so one interesting thing is that, you know, do you guys support type inference? Like, for example, here, you know, I have to explicitly say this is a non-null string, but, you know, if I would write, you know, somewhere in the code, you know, instead of string s equals this var s, and then, you know, can you infer then that it's kind of non-null and stuff like that? Yeah.
So the analysis is path sensitive, so it knows exactly over which conditions the execution has taken place and correspondingly tracks non-nullness. For example, for local variables, you don't have to annotate whether they are non-null or null. We require it currently for method signatures because we want to make it explicit that is part of the contract that we expect that a given parameter is non-null from the caller. And it shows up in method tooltips and elsewhere.
So one important consequence of this pair-sensitive analysis is that if you write something like if x is different from null, then within the block of this if statement, we would treat x as actually being of a non-null type. So from then on, you don't have to cast it down to a non-null type anymore. So this gives us...
That would be so beautiful if we also had that with, you know, is, right? You know, the is test, you know, or... Beautiful.
Okay. Let me show some of that type inference that we do in the next method. Next chunk, we certainly would expect here to return a non-null string as well. So let me change the type a bit to be a non-null string. But you can see that we're still getting no complaint when we return s, whose type is declared to be a string. And the reason is that we know that the substring method returns a non-null string, which we can see here. And so the inference in our type checker infers that the non-null value that flows from the return of substring into s, when we return it, it is non-null as we expect.
That's interesting here because, you know, the declare type of s says that it is a string.
Yep.
And I assume that string is a subtype of non-null string, or
the other way around. String is a super type of non-null string because it has a larger set of possible values, right?
But here you seem to kind of, you know, now infer kind of, you know, a better type than what I declared, which is a little bit unusual.
Yes, but that is how it works. Okay. And if there were intervening assignments in between, we would detect those as well as perhaps assigning null to it. So these checks are quite similar to the definite assignment checks that are being done. But for definite assignment, once you have assigned something, it remains assigned all the time.
Yeah.
And here you have to look at every assignment. Okay. Is it time to show a pre- and post-condition contract, perhaps, in our code?
That would be great, because we talk about that in the Eiffel programming language that exists by default.
Great.
And what we didn't really see any Eiffel code with, so we could see a similar concept in a very user... Most of us are looking at C# all the time, or Java, so this looks nice. So yes,
great,
please.
So a post condition that we might want to say about next chunk, we might want to say something more about the return value, other than that it's non-null and that it's a string. So therefore, we can declare a post condition, which we do with the ensures keyword, and after ensures, we just write an expression in the language. But we can use the special keyword result, which stands for the value returned by the method. So we can say that the length of the result is equal to chunk size. So the advantage with having specifications like this in the language is that the moment that the programmer thinks of a condition like this, there's room in the language to write it down in a formal place where you then get the runtime checks. That checks that this post condition is really there. We get the documentation support that says this is a post condition of the method, so the caller knows he can rely on that. And furthermore, when we apply our static verification tools, which we'll show here in the demo as well, the static verification tool will both check and make use of these pre and post conditions.
So now here I have a completely kind of crazy question. So what you know, suppose I'm a kind of an experienced spec sharp user, and I would write as my post condition result equals source dot next chunk or something like that, right? Or this dot next chunk. So I write this kind of really weird kind of recursive post condition that is defined in terms of the function itself.
SpecSharp does check that the specifications are valid for. So, for instance, when you write a recursive specification, there is a proof obligation that the recursion is actually well-founded, and we have various ways of providing arguments what the order is according to which it is well-founded. So there is some protection that keeps the programmer from writing stupid things. I'm not sure we are absolutely watertight there, but at least we catch many of the problems that you could introduce.
Yeah. And so are there any kind of what would be the kind of restrictions? What can I write in these post conditions?
In some sense, you can write arbitrary expressions. These expressions shouldn't have an effect on the existing state, so they should be side effect free. These expressions can call functions, and these functions then have to be pure so that they don't change the state. It actually happens that they can allocate new memory, but as long as you don't compare the identity of that new memory or take the hash code of that new memory, you can't observe that that piece of contract has any side effect on the rest of the program. And you have better make sure, as Peter said, that all those computations actually terminate.
Yeah.
And that's mainly it.
So you can run Terminator over it.
You could run Terminator over it, except that Terminator works for C and not for .NET.
Understood.
And is there any support? Like you said, these functions must be pure. Is there any built-in post condition that says ensures it doesn't have side effects, or how do you kind of track purity as well?
Yeah, we do. So we do have a purity checker, which is currently, a bit more restrictive than we would like to in the long run, but at least for many pure methods, we can actually assert that they are pure.
Yeah, that's cool. And can you say a little bit more about that? How?
So you can check purity in various ways. We actually have two purity checkers, because we think that purity is really also very important in the context of concurrency, so it's part of our research effort to look into what we can do with purity. So the one purity checker is built on a pointer analysis that actually tracks all read-write effects, and then it simply makes sure that there are no write effects. And another purity checker is based on our verification engine, and maybe Russo or Peter can.
Right. So we allow, in addition to, so purity, if you mark a method as being pure, it says that it has no visible side effects. But you can also say what side effects it does have. So in addition to pre and post conditions for a method, you can write modifies clauses that say, for example, you only modify such and such a field of the method, or so that means that you contain even the modifications that you have. So it's not all or nothing. And that is also checked by our program verifier, the static program verifier. Those are not checked at runtime, because at least the naive ways of checking that you've only modified what you say you did are quite expensive.
And do you track only kind of state modifications, or also things like exceptions, or whether you kind of spin up threads, or kind of other effects?
We do not check whether or not you spin up threads. We know how to handle exceptions, but we've never implemented those in the static verifier. We know how to do it. It's just not been at the top of our list.
Okay, interesting.
Okay, so let's take a look at what happens inside the next chunk implementation. So here we also get a squiggly, a green squiggly from the programming system. What we've talked about so far have been type checks that are performed by the type checker. Now we're getting into more advanced sorts of checks that are actually being done by a static program verifier that we're running in the background here. The programmer might not see the difference between the type checker and the program verifier. They will just look like error messages. But to us technology savvy people, we'd like to know that it's a different engine. Okay, so the problem, the complaint that we're getting here is that the call to substring that we're making does not satisfy one of the preconditions of the substring method. Now, the substring method is declared in the library, and what we have done is we have formalized some of those contracts, which otherwise sit just in the documentation of the .NET library and in some runtime checks. We have formalized those in such a way that our tool can actually read them. So I can show you what the entire contract of substring is. It shows a few preconditions and a postcondition. If you look at the postcondition, it only says in this case what the length of the result is, which is a very weak postcondition. It does not say anything about what the contents of the string that's being returned is. In the textbooks that when we learn about pre and postconditions, we would see very elaborate postconditions and probably very small preconditions. But in the more engineering practice, what we find is more cost-effective is to try to write some forms of specifications, but they're not going to cover everything. If you cover everything, that is the full functional correctness, you will first find that the contracts that you write are very long, and in many cases will take a deep mathematical understanding even to define them. Mm. But then our automatic checking technology also runs out of steam if you make things or write things that are too complicated.
Plus that the contract might be then as complicated as the implementation,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And now you've just moved the problem one level up.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that a good way to think about it is think about the pre- and post-conditions that you write in the language as things that you perhaps would be willing to have runtime checks for. That is, they're of that level. So using those, we can then see that the program verifier here complains about the precondition. It complains about several preconditions. And actually, we can see several of them down below here. Actually, let me focus on this one first, which says that the start index, which is the first parameter to substring, it has to be at least 0. And here we're passing in n as the value of that parameter. And so the program verifier has detected the possibility that n might not be non-negative, or at least it cannot ascertain that it always will be non-negative. So what we really intend to do here is the field n that we have declared, we intend it always to be at least 0, as this English remark here says. So we can formalize that by writing an invariant. This invariant is an object invariant. It says that this is a condition that holds of all objects of the class, at least always hold of the object in the steady states of the object. And I will just simply say that it lies on that side of 0. Now if we look at the bottom of the screen and the error messages, that error message went away.
So would you have something like that when I have an unsigned int or something, that it would automatically infer this invariant?
We do know that verifier knows that unsigned ints are at least 0. But as anyone who's used both unsigned and signed integers knows, it's really tricky when you start using the unsigned integers, because now if you assign, if you take a signed integer and put it into an unsigned, all sorts of, overflows can happen going that way or going the other way around. Here, by writing a condition that n is at least 0, that essentially means if you think of it as a 32-bit quantity, then we're not using one of those bits, which actually really simplifies programming in many different ways, and that's something that the type system with a uint doesn't give you. Okay, so let's take a look at the next error message we're getting. That's another precondition violation. This one complains about the length parameter, which is the other parameter to substring, and it says that it also needs to be at least zero. So here also we intend chunk size to be at least zero. So let's write that down also as an invariant in the program. Now, anytime that you write these invariants, and you have a choice in what you write, they don't have to be of this form all the time. And when you get more experience with using the invariants, you would just tend to write these things down. You would declare something like chunk size, and immediately afterwards you would think, oh, but I want it to be at least zero. But there could be other possibilities. You can write Boolean conditions here that say under which circumstances the thing is at least zero. Or you might choose to say, for example, that it's even positive if that's what you want.
And these invariants can be in terms of all the kind of, you know, fields of
yes,
the class?
Yes, they can be in terms of all of the fields of the class. Once you get into more advanced invariants, there are some restrictions in what you can put into them just so that we can make sure that we can check them. And those restrictions have to do with when you talk about several objects. But here we're just using several fields of the same object, and those are easy. Okay, so now I've added that invariant, which then records our design decision that chunk size should be at least zero. What we're getting now is a complaint at the end of the constructor. At the end of the constructor, we check that the object invariant holds. And here, the program verifier has detected a possible violation that we might not satisfy that invariant that we said that we would have. And the reason is that as an input argument, we just take any integer and we put it into the field. So again, we could write some defensive code here, but really the best way to solve this problem is to write the precondition of the constructor. So here's the real power of using contracts in your programming, because you can say exactly what you assume and protect yourself and move the responsibility of certain things onto the caller. So instead of us having to deal with lots of random input values that make no sense, we put an obligation onto the caller to say, don't ever call us with these bad values.
So plus that you also kind of move it out of the code into something that's much more accessible to tools and to, you know,
and it's
for the human reader and so on. I don't have to dig through this code to figure out, you know, what the preconditions really are.
Exactly.
Know?
The code becomes, the contracts, the obligations become clearer, the code becomes cleaner, and we don't need to have all of these checks, because very often at the call site, you can... you can discharge these proof obligations quite easily, maybe in some cases trivially.
Interesting.
Okay, so the condition that we will write here is simply that the chunk size parameter should be at least zero, and we can then see the complaint at the end of the constructor goes away.
This is kind of a weird question again. It's like I noticed that you write, you know, your invariants like, you know, zero, less than equal, and I would kind of, you know, write them the other way around. Is there any reason that you write them in this particular form, or is it like style, or is this an easier style?
It's totally a matter of style. In my head, I like lining the things up from left to right. Then I can see where chunk size lies in with respect to zero. But if you want to write them the other way, go ahead. Many people write, well, we'll see that soon if I write another invariant. I'll come back to it.
Yes. It just struck me when you typed this. Yeah.
Right. It's a matter of style. The tool does not insist on it being this way. Okay, let's take a look at the third warning that we're getting in our call to substring. Now, this one is perhaps a little bit more interesting. It says that the parameters that we pass in, the start index and the length, they should not exceed the length of the string that we're operating on. So, in other words, n plus chunk size should be within the length of the source string that we're operating on. And that, in fact, in this case, might not be the case. If a caller repeatedly calls next chunk, we're eventually going to increase n to be large enough that this will stick out outside the string. Now, the designers of the substring method have made a decision here that you're not even allowed to call it unless the parameters satisfy these constraints. Other design decisions might be that, well, you're allowed to call it, and the result that you will get will be truncated or padded with blanks maybe or something. The important thing is that we make these sorts of decisions all the time when we program. And when you do, it's really good to be able to write them down. And that's something that you can do with the contracts because the contracts make explicit what you intend. So in this case, to fix this problem, we really need to change our code. This code as written is not good. So let's first check that if that m plus the chunk size does not exceed the length of the string. And and if so, we will do the assignment. And otherwise, we will do something else. And what I propose we do instead is let's use the other overloaded version of substring, and we will just simply skip the first n characters and go to the rest of the string. So by doing that, we now satisfy all of the preconditions of the first call to substring. Okay, but it didn't end there. So here we get a complaint in the second call to substring, that is the other version, and here it's complaining that the parameter that we pass in might exceed the length of the string. So we actually have somewhat of a similar problem here. So we need to make sure that n does not exceed the length of that string. And that's also something that we intend, that's a property of n that we intend it always to have, because it should be the number of characters returned so far, which could be as few as zero, and it could be as many as the entire string. And here, Eric, you see how my mind likes to have the n between the zero and the source length.
Yeah,
if you, some people write it the other way around, and at least maybe they can handle it, but my brain does not care for that one. It looks really strange to me. So write it in the style that pleases you, and it will be this one, surely, after a while. Okay. So so that takes care of the precondition of the second call to substring. Okay, anyone, any other comments to interject here, or should I continue with our next comment?
It's fascinating that you have not even typed, you know, debug run yet, and you put breakpoints and whatever. It's like, it's amazing.
None of that yet.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
Although we do. Our programs can execute as well, but
they do run. They don't just warm up the process.
That's right.
They do something as well.
They do something.
Cool.
If you want them to. Okay, let's take a look at the next one then. So here we have we're making an assignment to the n field, and it's complaining that we might be breaking the invariant that we set out to maintain. The invariant that n is no greater than the length of the source string. So this, I think, illustrates an important point. When some people think of contracts, they very often think of pre and post conditions to begin with, and those are very important because they protect us against callers, the preconditions especially, and the post conditions then say something that we're going to give in return. But one place where we can really get messed up in our programs is where we mess up the integrity of our data structures. We intend our data structures to have a certain shape, or satisfy certain properties, and it's easy to make a mistake. Or if we have some such thing in mind, and a different programmer comes in to deal with the code, as always happens, they might not know all of those assumptions. And by the declarations of the object invariants here, you can see exactly what we have assumed, what was needed to prove this code correct for these properties. So so here we've broken the invariant that we just introduced, namely this one here. And the reason is that, actually, we can look at the trace position here, which shows that this happens in the else branch of the, that is, when code flows through the else branch and we get down to this assignment, we might have violated the invariant. The reason
that's very interesting, because I can imagine that if you don't have that, it's extremely hard to figure out which statement violated the invariant.
Right. We've done some more work on trying to illustrate better to the programmer that something is wrong. Very often, a programmer's instinct is that the warnings come back are because of some some problem with the checker. The checker doesn't work right, and which does happen also, but very often it can also be a problem with the code. And in that case, it's really good if we're really slapped in the over the wrist with something that makes us really notice that there is our code that's at fault. So in this case, going through the else branch. Now we take the else branch because n plus the chunk size would exceed the length. So therefore, if we increase n by chunk size, we're not going to end up on the right side of length. So we would need to change this. There are several ways you could do this. We could maybe move this assignment into the then branch, and we'd have to think about what to do in the other one. But actually, the easiest way to fix it in this case is simply to increase n by the number of characters that we're returning, which is exactly what our English comment said that it would do. So we do that. And let me show you one more thing, which is now we get the complaint about the post condition that we also added some time ago. And it's really the same problem. When we wrote this post condition to begin with, we thought that we would be able to always return something of size, chunk size, but apparently we didn't think far enough ahead. And in the case that we take the else branch, what we return might not be of size, chunk size. So at this point, we also have a design decision to make. We could either change the code so that it satisfies this in some way, maybe insist that chunk size, write some additional conditions on next chunk, maybe pad the result with blanks or something. But really, I think that the easiest way to fix this is simply to change the spec. We'll say that what we return is no greater than chunk size. And that makes some people nervous that we're changing specs, but the problem with changing specs, changing contracts, is that we mess up all of the callers that relied on something. But if we have checking verification like this at our disposal, when you re-verify all of the callers, we will immediately know which ones relied on more than the new specification, and we can detect those things. So with that,
now we're going to run it.
What would we do? Charles doesn't believe it. He wants to see it run.
Let's see. I think we're compiling this as a library, or we not?
That's okay.
We would.
It would compile and do something when you gave it some input.
Yes.
Right. Very interesting. Now, the only thing that I'm struck with is that I could see as a developer getting into an infinite loop of spending an incredible amount of time making it just right so that I write this side effect free imperative non-functional programming stuff, right? C#, I like being able to have side effects because it makes my life easier to get my job done, right? Let's be honest. Side effect prone programming involves productivity to some degree. And you don't have to be a scientist to write useful programs. So my only question is, I mean, have there been any big projects that have actually used Spec# to compile, you know, a large amount of code? And what was the experience?
So in some sense, Microsoft has actually a very good experience with contracts. So I think even in 1999 and 2000, we started actually developing contracts for C. And that's the prefix prefast project.
Okay.
And I think Windows Server 2003, 13% of all the bugs that were found were actually found by automatic tools like Spec# in the existing Windows code base.
Excellent.
So that saved millions of dollars in test effort that would otherwise have been put in manually in order to find those bugs.
Uh-huh.
So we think this is the right direction forward. It also happened that, in some sense, we have learned from the past. So the first checkers were actually, in some sense, unsound. So they were, in some sense, bug-finding tools.
Mm.
And what we did over the past years, in some sense, increase the precision of these tools in order to make sure that if this checker, the Spec# checker, says there is no error of this particular kind, mm-hmm. then you don't have to test for it. It guarantees it for all possible paths through the program.
Excellent. And that comes to the core of the strength of contracts.
Exactly.
This is why we would use contracts in the first place, right?
Yeah, exactly. So in some sense, every product that we sell should be as bug-free as possible, and we want
sure.
to use the best tools available, and that holds for if you have whatever fiscal data that you want to protect, you better make sure that it obeys the contracts like...
So let me ask you this, because I've asked Bertrand Meyer this, I've asked Eric this a ton of times, I've asked other scientist types. Why is it? I mean, contracts are nothing new, right? Contracts have been around for a while. Why is it that the general purpose programmer of today has no concept of writing code like this? We're writing completely different style of code.
Yes, or even
so what's
let me,
going
let
on
me
here?
Take it to the extremes. If I see this, why on earth would anybody want to have a dynamically typed language if, you know, the compiler can do all this checking and help me to kind of prevent bugs? I mean, this looks, you know, I mean, I cannot wait to kind of, you know, to have this for real.
So I think one of the problems is that writing the contract first comes as more work to do, right? So it you might get the impression it slows you down or you get your results later, because, I mean, otherwise testing comes later, so why worry about testing now, right? But contracts you have to write immediately. So I think one of the keys to success is to provide many ways of getting benefits out of the contracts, to have test support through runtime checking, to have static verification, to have documentation support, to really give the programmer enough benefit for the time he spends writing the contracts. And I think with SpecSharp, they are really trying to find this sweet spot that Rustin mentioned earlier, not to provide like full functional specifications that are really painful to write, but just highlighting like the key issues that we want to rely on and checking those. And that works just fine. And for instance, one thing we can do in SpecSharp, if we find that the static checking becomes too painful, we can just put in an assume statement, which means that the verifier will just trust you that whatever you put there is correct, which might be unsound, of course, but you will get a runtime check for that. So in the worst case, that's an easy way of getting around too painful static verification.
Very interesting.
As we go on with tools like this into the future, one of the things that a good engineer will learn is just when to apply these assume statements. That is, you get into situations where you try to make your code nicer, specify more and more things, and you really get into it, which is really great, and that's what we should do when we get into when you really want to prove everything of the code. Mm-hmm. But often it could be that it's not cost effective to continue down that path.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, the sensible thing to do is just to put in an assume statement that says, make this runtime check here, and then go on with the checking. And that means that the code reviews that we do, the manual code reviews,
mm-hmm.
Can just home in on those assume statements, and you can discuss whether or not they hold at that point. And that's something that you then don't have to convince the checker of, but only your colleagues that is correct.
And so what, from a, you know, theoretically, I mean, why allow that to happen? It's a similar thing to saying, you know, don't check for buffer overruns in this chunk of code.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? It takes input from something that you can't trust, and we don't know exactly what's going on. So why did you allow, why the assume keywords?
Let me give an example.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose that you want to write the specifications at the level that we've shown here in the demo,
mm-hmm.
But it might still be that what you rely on is when you call something. For example, you have an array that you want to sort, and you call the sorting routine,
mm-hmm.
and then you rely on maybe that the result it really is sorted, because maybe you're subtracting off consecutive values in the array and expect them to be non-negative. Perhaps you start off with all even values in the array, and you expect them to all come back even because there should be a permutation of what you got. Now, if your code really depends on that, that means that you need to have specifications of the sorting routine that are much stronger. They would have to maybe talk about how the thing is sorted, which you can actually write using a quantifier, which we support in SpecSharp.
Mm-hmm.
But you probably also then have to write that it's a permutation of the input. And that's actually, now you're really getting into mathematical waters that are much trickier to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of doing that, we know that the sorting routine is supposed to sort, And you can maybe test by other means that you don't lose any values, that it really is a permutation. Mm-hmm. In that case, it seems more cost effective to just introduce an assume somewhere in your code that says when you subtract off the consecutive values in the array, you get something that's non-negative, for example.
Yeah. Plus, that you're not kind of hiding it, right? I mean, it's kind of it's right there, kind of probably in the IDE. You should make that with the blink tag. That would be a good use of the blink tag, right? Assume. So I have a question about those same things. You use this kind of this trace statement, right? One of the things, and that you also see in other languages that have powerful type system like Haskell, is that a lot of the debugging kind of switches from runtime to compile time, right? Because, you know, like all the bugs that you found here, you know, we found them at compile time. But, you know, the nice thing about runtime debugging is that you have a lot of context, right? You have your call stack, you can inspect, you know, everything. Whereas usually at the type level, the kind of debugging in that sense is not that nice, right? You know, the type checker says, you know, there's something wrong and, you know, there's no way to kind of inspect, you know, where in the proof did it fail or something like that. So do you guys think about, like, those aspects of type debugging, so to speak?
Yes, in some sense, we do that. We've seen that track exactly the application of the invariant, for example, through the code in order to see the possible control flow that is taken when an invariant is broken. And so we map the errors back to the invariants or preconditions that are violated, exactly like on the level that you would get in a normal debugger. But since this is a modular verifier, so that means that we verify each method in isolation by only relying on the contracts of the called methods. That's why we don't look at possible dynamic executions, but we verify it for all possible executions. So in some sense, we don't have to rely on the fact that this happens in this particular execution, because we will tell you it happens either not at all, or it can happen there is an error because it can happen in at least one execution. So there is a related project which is called PEX for Program Exploration, where we, in some sense, if a contract fails, we can generate a test case as well, and then you can take that test case into the debugger. But that is a little bit further out. So then we can talk in half a year or so how we could even improve this scenario.
Okay, and what happens if, like, the solver is unable to solve something? How do you present that to the user? You know, do you say, you know, could not kind of simplify this giant expression, or could not prove that this implies that, or how would that work?
It comes out in one of two ways. One way is that it takes an enormous amount of time, and you get impatient and you wish that it had come back.
Yeah.
For that, you can set the time limit. This does happen. Another thing that would happen is that if it does complete, that is, if it returns something that looks like a counterexample as far as the tool can tell, it might not be a counterexample. For example, our tool understands linear arithmetic, but does not understand that x times x is at least 0, for example. So if you have a program that really relies on that x times x is at least 0, it will come out as an error. The tool will say, I cannot prove this thing here.
And that would be where you would use an assume, for example.
Exactly. That would be an excellent use of an assume. And those situations do happen, more often than not, I would say that the sorts of errors that we get back from the checker are because of lack of other specifications somewhere else. That is, you haven't specified something that needs to be information that the checker needs.
So another interesting thing that I would like to kind of learn more about is when you talk about invariants. You know, sometimes, you know, the invariant doesn't hold for a certain amount of time, or when I have kind of complicated data structures where, you know, there's pointers from, you know, all kind of directions into my data structures, where it's kind of hard to ensure that nobody from the outside messes up my invariants. Mm-hmm. Do you guys solve that problem?
Yeah, so I think scientifically that's one of the most important challenges that we addressed and solved in this Beckshard problem. So basically we can make sure that we can track invariants even if your program contains callbacks. So even if you have a situation that you break an invariant temporarily, then you call out to another object and that object calls back into you. We will find such situations. We can also handle invariants that talk about several objects. So for instance, say you have a linked list data structure and you want to maintain invariants over those. So our approach is to provide the programmer with a programming methodology. We give the programmer ways to express why he thinks his program maintains the invariants. For instance, because the invariant depends on state that is immutable, so it's fine to be shared, or because the invariant depends on state that is not shared, or because the invariant depends on state that is only modified by certain methods or methods of certain objects. And that allows us to precisely define the points where we have to check the invariants to make sure they actually hold whenever we want to assume them. So this is actually, I think, scientifically, like one of the core contributions that we made there.
And can you also deal with invariants and so on in the context of concurrency, where there's kind of multiple threads, kind of, you know, banging on, you know, things?
So if when you get into concurrency, our general approach is to try to structure the code in such a way that you can reason about it sequentially for as long as possible, and then you know when there might be interference from other threads. That's something that we have not implemented in our version of SpecSharp, but there's an offshoot of SpecSharp developed by in Leuven in Belgium called SpecSharp Leuven that has some support for that. So we've written some papers on that subject, but we've not implemented it in our version. I could show just a quick thing to emphasize what Peter said there also. The one of the tricky issues is that you do break invariants sometimes. So if I were to give just a very simple example of, suppose that I have another variable nn, and I write an invariant that says that I intend n and nn to be the same value, which of course is a silly example, but something more realistic would be that maybe NN stands for the length of some other array, and maybe or the length of a string builder or something like that. So when we increase N, we also want to increase it in the other end. So if you do something like that, then here you're getting a complaint, well, because we're not updating NN at all. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to update NN in the same go as N. But now, notice that there's no way to order those two statements in such a way that the invariant always holds. We need to
parallel assignment in C#.
Right, and yep, and we don't have that here. So, so what we have instead is a statement that we call expose, which is a little bit like the lock statement. And so you can expose an object, and by exposing it, you get permission to violate its invariant from that curly brace to this curly brace. So now we check it only at the end again. To begin with, when we started the SpecSharp project, we required these expose statements everywhere whenever you were to change the state, and which is some people have liked because they say they like seeing when things change. But I think that by and large it makes the programs look quite different from the programs that we tend to write. So we've done various things to allow you to not have to put in these expose statements. But in this case, you have to, because there will be a point where the invariant does not hold.
And maybe I can refer back to the concurrency. What we see here is when you want to introduce locks is exactly when you want to protect a certain group of fields. And if you wanted to protect this invariant, you would have to introduce this lock exactly at the place where the expose statement is. So it's a very natural move from thread-based programming, where you want to preserve invariants, to our methodology and back. And in some sense, it's merged nicely.
So if we go back to the kind of, you know, the software engineering part, so one thing that struck me when you wrote this code, you know, when you got the error that the invariant was broken, it would be nice if there would be one of those smart tags that says, you know, here's how you can fix it. Because I assume that this expose statement, you can just infer that, you know, how do I, you know, make the invariant hold
wonderful.
Again?
Right. We would love to have that as well. Some other projects have explored that to some extent, and we would love to have such features as well. We have not done any of that actually in Spectre at this point.
So in some sense, forward-looking, I recently told already about the PEX project, which is this test case generation project. And as part of the test case generation, it also infers a precondition. So it will give you the right click to add additional contracts, and it could also add the additional expose statement.
So I also have heard of people that do kind of, you know, dynamic analysis where they kind of, you know, from the, they infer the invariance. And then it would be nice that, you know, if you kind of run, you know, some, you train the program and then you get the invariance and then I can put them in my code, you know, such that when I, you know, change my code, you know, I know that these invariants are maintained.
So we don't have any support for something like that, but SpecSharp, or the program verifier Boogie, just works on MSIL code, which is enriched by these contracts. So when we have this common platform, so you can take any tool you like, say an abstract interpreter, a runtime checker, whatever you want, to come up with specifications, put it into the CIL, and then if it is in the right format, our verifier will be able to pick up the specifications and use them. So in that sense, you are not basically locked into our tool set. I mean, you can always extend it by adding more tools.
Yeah, so you raise an interesting question. So is how much of this is tied to SpecSharp, and how much is this applicable to IL, or, you know, you mentioned, you know, there's a prover underneath, you know, can I do this for Visual Basic as well?
Most of what we do is, that is the meat and potato of the checker deals with just IL instructions. So in that sense, it could be anything. But if you want to get far in your specifications, you really need to rely on contracts of other methods and being able to write contract yourself. And then, as Peter said, those need to then somehow enter the IL in some form that our tools can understand. And that's something that we would like to see much more of. In the future, that the that others could use that same format, so that's the limitation right now. It's not. It doesn't. I mean, the various .NET languages they're similar to in many different ways, and we could handle them if we just had contracts. Because you need the contracts if you shouldn't spew out too many spurious warnings.
So another thing that you haven't shown, I'm not sure if that's still in there, but at some point you had like a throws clause, right, like where you could see which exceptions are thrown. Is that still in there?
It is still in there, yes. And the we separate exceptions. That is, what we do in .NET is we introduce a new kind of exception to .NET, which is a checked exception, which is much like
with
Java.
Or Java.
Right. And module 3 also had such. It only had the checked exceptions. We treat the unchecked exceptions and the checked exceptions in different ways. And as we have expressed in a paper that we wrote on the subject, we think that it's really important that when you have exceptions and you deal with them, that you think about what is the purpose behind a particular exception. Is this an exception that you intend anyone to catch? I mean, is it a disastrous problem in your program, or is it something that is sort of anticipated? You call some methods on, and you find that a socket has been closed. And that's something that the programmer is aware of, but you don't want to check that with every statement. So you want to be able to anticipate that condition, that the socket might close underneath you, and then have the code that handles that situation in one place, which is what exceptions are really wonderful for. But if you violate a precondition, if you call something that violates a precondition, or if you step outside the bounds of an array, those also give rise to exceptions. But those are exceptions that what could you possibly do if you got one? I mean, you just have to restart your program. There's something seriously wrong with your program. Mm. Or if you run out of memory, that's one that sometimes you could do something about. But if you run out of memory, it could be that that your whole world is about to go down.
Certainly. So, catch out of memory exception.
Right. So what we do, so we don't check for that is the kind of runtime exceptions that you could get from nulldy references, array bounds, errors, and so forth. We just check in our static verifier that they don't happen. That is, we treat them as errors. And for the checked exceptions, then you would have to have a picture in your mind of this is something that I really want programmers to check. Mm-hmm. And with the throws clauses that we have, that means that we can make sure in the compiler that there's some handler for it somewhere, that you don't forget about them, and that we think is important as well.
But it's not a required throws, like in Java, right?
Yeah.
Java also divides exceptions between checked and unchecked.
Okay.
And another question is, like, how does this kind of relate with generics, and especially with, like, constraints in generics? So, you know, suppose I have, you know, like a list, and I want to put some, you know, preconditions on the type parameter, or and the other thing is, like, with delegates, suppose I get, you know, a delegate parameter, can I specify what the pre and post conditions of that delegate are?
So I have done some work on paper to support delegates. There is no implementation yet, but the idea would basically be to also associate a delegate with the pre and the post condition, and then when you instantiate the delegate, you would have to prove that the method, the specification of the method that you provide, is a refinement of the specification of the delegate. So it takes a weaker precondition and provides a stronger post condition. For the constraints on generics, the way we would have to do it would be to, for instance, define an interface with a contract to require, and then take this interface as an upper bound on the type variable. And that would enforce that what you really instantiate the generic with satisfies that specification.
But requiring an interface is kind of, you know, quite, you know, expensive for it. But so what I would like to say is, like, there's a T, and I want to say, I assume, you know, something about this type T, about the contract that, you know, an invariant, say, of that type T, which is not described in the interface, right? So in some sense, the contract or the invariants of a type now become part of their interface, but they don't kind of show up in interfaces. Or can I put a contract on an interface and then assume that, you know, every... Do you take out the contracts from that interface?
So you can then, if you define another interface and put the contract on that, you can then constrain the generic parameters like you can in C#, for example, to say that it must implement one of those. That interface.
I was looking for is, can you separate the notion of contract and interface, you know, such that I can kind of reuse a contract and say, you know, I want to put that.
Right. We don't do that at this point. I think that what you're describing is easier in the dynamically typed languages, which is some of the appeal that those languages have, that you would mix in contracts and so forth. You don't have to think about what interface it is and plan ahead of time that there should be a named interface that has certain properties. But that also makes the checking more complicated. So what I would love to see is that we would develop over the next probably many years, are ways to fuse those together to try to get some of the benefits that you can get from the dynamically typed languages, being able to prototype quickly, not think too hard about your code when you write it, maybe, and then and it often works, and then be able to tighten the screws on it in such a way that you can actually get a program that is reliable, that you know to some extent is more reliable afterwards. And that's, I think, a lot of research would have to be done there, because most of the verification work that's been done is indeed, they take a step further from static typing. Mm-hmm. Static typing is then taken for granted to begin with, even.
Yes, so what you're saying is we should really have kind of a wide spectrum from kind of no static types at all to kind of, you know, extremely strong static types and anywhere in between.
It would be great to have.
Yes.
It's unclear actually how that would pan out, but I would say if we could achieve something like that, or at least take steps toward that, that would be wonderful.
Yeah. So because right now there's a kind of, you know, big divide, right? You know, you fall into, you know, a hole in between, and there's no nice continuum.
Could you
except
have
for VB a little bit?
Could you have contracts on like the language that Gilad's writing, pure virtual types? And could you have a contract on a system that's not typed, statically typed, or dynamically typed, pure virtual?
You certainly can. The question is then how do you actually reason about it? I mean, if you just want runtime checking for that, then you could just say, by putting the following clauses into your program, you will get runtime checking here and there. But then if you actually try to prove something with a static verifier, then you typically need more information, and then it might not be as clear what to do.
So basically one thing we do is every time you can get a runtime error in C#, we put a proof obligation that this error doesn't occur. So now you live in an untyped world. One of the possible errors is like message not understood, right? So we put a proof obligation everywhere that this does not occur, and then proving this proof obligation essentially means you prove that your program is well-typed. I mean, that can still be more flexible than a static type system, but you get the same kind of obligations in the end.
Excellent.
Right. And for those places where you always live by those static typing rules, I'm sure that's a quicker way to get to those checks. It would be a clumsier solution to have to write fuller contracts for it, but it would be more flexible. So finding a mix of those two would be great.
So one thing that has always kind of bothered me a little bit is that if you look at, you know, the pre and post conditions, well, normal type signatures are also like pre and post conditions. So I would really like to write, and this is maybe kind of going into that direction, right? I want to write no signatures, or I want to, in my precondition, I want to say this parameter is a string, right? Because why should I kind of write that in a different way than, you know, the requires clause? And do you think that, like, you know, there would be a way to kind of, you know, cross the divide in that way?
So in some sense, this is a direction that has been taken up in the formal methods community for a long time. There you have actually then an unsorted logic, but then you actually put every additional constraint, also that this variable now can only be in an integer or can be in this range or has to be of this particular type. You put it all as additional constraints, and you could solve then those constraints over your program. So a language that does that is TLA, which was also developed by one of the Microsoft researchers, Leslie Lampard, earlier. So this is possible, but again, it's a very purist view, and what we also have to deal with is actually making the system well engineered so that
I'm a purist.
You are.
Yeah. Okay.
But we have to have one question. I mean, what's going on with that getup? Where's your tie-dye? What's going on here?
Well, you know,
I know we're with some very famous people here, but what's going on?
Well, it's close to Queen's Day, so, you know, being Dutch, I want to kind of pay tribute to our queen, you know, by wearing my orange tie, so.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you, we didn't really ask any, so where are you from? What's your story?
I'm from Germany originally, from a town close to Munich, and before I came to MSR, I worked at ETH in Zurich in Switzerland.
Excellent. He comes from Bertram Meyers.
Bertram Meyers camp?
Well, we were colleagues at the same institution, yeah.
Excellent.
Okay. I also come from Germany. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a rural area, moved to Berlin and to Munich and to other cities in Germany before coming to Microsoft, and worked on SpecShop and predecessors of Link and do other fun stuff that I can talk about another time.
Excellent.
I was born in Sweden, but I've been in the U.S. since high school. Before I worked at Microsoft Research, I worked at a lab in California that belonged to DEC and Compaq, developing some similar tools for Java, for Module 3, and so forth. I've also worked at Microsoft as a developer, beginning in the early 80s, and shipped code in some Windows 3.0, for example.
Excellent. Well, there's probably a little bit of that left in Vista, but no, maybe not. All right. Well, hey, I've taken up a lot of your time, and this, you know, we wanted to get an idea of what's going on with SpecSharp. I think we have one now, for sure.
And you were going to place the URL for the SpecSharp download, I guess, somewhere
near the video.
Absolutely.
You better believe it. We want people to play around with this. I mean, because there are people who have played around with this, namely the singularity people.
Yeah.
I mean, singularity is written in Spec Sharp, yes?
Yeah, so the Sing Sharp language is an extension for Spec Sharp, and what singularity really tried to do is actually push contracts as far as possible so that they have software-isolated processes. Mm-hmm. And so it extends some of the concepts that we have shown here in new directions, but in some sense it's based on the same ideas, push static checking to give more guarantees for reliability.
Outstanding. Perfect. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for another great episode,
yep,
Eric.
It was my pleasure, and thank you guys again. It was really impressive. And
cool.
It's very good work. Keep it up.
Totally.
Thanks.